and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I'm your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Nikta Sadati, who is doing a PhD in English Language and Literature under the supervision of Dr. Chris Bongi. Welcome to Grad Chat, Nikta.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what made you want to come on the show?
My friend was actually on the show a few weeks ago.
Oh, was that Basma?
It was
right,
Basma.
Right. We've got you all in.
Yes, the network has begun.
Excellent.
So there'll be way more English students to come.
So are you wanting to do this more for your own learning, or is it because you feel like, you know, you've got such a great topic, you want more people to know about it?
Honestly, I've had a lot of experience with the elevator pitch of my project. A lot of my friends are in engineering. It just so happened that way. I'm friends with a lot of my high school friends. So they're in sciences, engineering, business, and they'll ask me at parties, you know, what's your research? And I have to do it in 2 minutes to someone who maybe hasn't read a book in years.
I love it.
I've had a lot of kind of experiences with different reactions, different language I've tried to use. And I just thought, why not come on here to really experiment with how I speak about my research in a longer form?
Right.
I think it'd be really helpful in the future as well, because I think the most impactful research is the most accessible research.
Exactly.
So I hope this can help with gaining more language to speak about it.
And it also means those conversations can go a bit longer at those parties.
Yeah, that would help.
Otherwise, there's a lot of, you know those little, what do we call those things where you just say just enough to get something started and you hope someone else is going to continue the conversation, because I know just enough information and then that's it.
Right, exactly.
But it's nice if you can sort of continue it, particularly if people ask you questions back.
Exactly.
So, I'm glad you're doing that. What is your background then? Because if all your friends were, say, in STEM disciplines and you went into English, what made you want to go into do the English or humanities?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it started in grade 7.
Right.
I've always loved reading as a child. I was the kid whose parents would tell her not stop reading, enjoy the vacation, stop reading all your books. And so in grade 7, I sort of decided that I wanted to study English, but I wanted to be an English teacher.
Right.
So originally that was what I wanted to do. I minored in education and I just love storytelling. I find books the greatest way to kind of learn about empathy and learn about the world. And being a first generation Canadian, it was amazing to have this kind of way to read about the world when sometimes the curriculum wasn't teaching you about the world.
Right. Yeah. So. But I mean, that's tricky too, because it's finding the right books, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That can help you out, which is kind of segueing into a bit of what you're going to be talking about. But with that then, so you did a little bit of minor in education, which is great. But why a PhD?
Yeah. So
because what are your aspirations?
When I reached undergrad, I did a few student teacher positions at different elementary schools and high schools. And while I absolutely enjoyed that, I think what I realized was my favorite part was really digging deeper into the literature with the students. And I got to do that with a lot of the AP classes, but it just felt like it wasn't enough. Right. And so I realized if I really wanted to do that, then I can sort of combine my love for education, combine my love for this close analysis, and take it a step further and hopefully kind of train with the PhD to both, you know, talk about this really niche interest I have, but also in the future to potentially be able to be a professor and kind of teach those sorts of classes and sort of expand those sorts of subjects.
Which must be quite rewarding, I would imagine, when you're digging into a particular book and then you're getting the students to let you know of what they're getting from it. And we can all have such different ideas, can't we, from a book?
Absolutely. That's why I love when I can get a bunch of essays from students that are all sort of reading the same book in different ways. It's just about the bravery of taking the step to have a reading that's different from your professor's.
True. But I always thought with programs like that, how do you judge them, right? Because there's no really wrong answer, I would have thought, but it's how they put those words on paper, I guess. But I mean, it must be very difficult to mark papers when they are so different, but they've got a good perspective.
Yeah, I think one of the common misconceptions is that all of marking in English is subjective. You know,
okay.
Students will say, oh, it's just my professor didn't like me very much or didn't like my style. But I think we really build foundation blocks. So when we teach first year, it's very formulaic. And we're just marking you on, can you write an introduction the way that we've taught you to write an introduction? Can you do the analysis? Have you provided proof? Is there a conclusion?
Right.
And then from there, it sort of builds where you can utilize the formula to then come up with creative sort of arguments. And then that starts to play a role in your mark as you kind of go up in the years. Oh. So in the core of it, there is a formula that we're asking you to follow. You know, is your thesis argumentative? Do you have evidence? Are you close reading the evidence?
Right.
All these things have to be there for kind of base grade. And then as you kind of continue up, what ends up happening is the kind of quality of your argument is based on how much you can anchor it in the text and prove it to me. So anything can be right as long as you can prove it.
Prove it. Okay, I clearly needed to take your class because I never did quite well. And I used to always think it was just my grammar was really bad. But
I mean, that is important as
well. So thank you for doing that. Maybe I need to go back to school. And start from scratch. But okay, enough on that. Let's get on to your topic, because that's why we've brought you here. Your research topic is Afrofuturism and diaspora studies.
Mm-hmm.
Two big words.
Yeah.
I'd actually never heard of the word Afrofuturism before. So can you first of all just give us a bit of an overview of what you are researching apart from those two words?
Yes. So just to kind of dive deeper, the way I always start is I ask people if they've seen Black Panther.
Yeah, because I actually looked that up to see what kind of things that you would be looking at. And Black Panther was one of them.
Yes.
So yay.
That is the most sort of known mainstream example of Afrofuturism. But
okay,
essentially, I'm looking at this in literature. So it's literature that's taking the kind of generic format of science fiction and fantasy and mixing it with African traditions and African folklore and culture. So that's happening a lot in contemporary literature right now, and it's a huge trend. And so what I'm looking at is all of these texts have an aspect of diaspora to them, which is when you move from your point of origin to another country.
Right.
So it's that movement, and then it also refers to the places one might move. So the African diaspora would be referring to people moving from Africa to another country.
Another country.
Also, the countries that have the most people that have moved from Africa. That's sort of the African diaspora. So what I'm looking at in these texts is that all of them have these fantastical features of alternative timelines, so maybe not following chronological time. There's texts that I'm reading that they're living on a spaceship. Oh. And sort of have left Earth as this dystopic sort of text. There's texts where people are possessed with the ghosts of historical figures. So utilizing all these kind of surreal elements to tell the stories of African traditions and histories and to kind of project them into these almost futuristic worlds.
I love it. I love it. So basically, Afrofuturism is looking at the culture and how it's been incorporated into everyday life or literature or movies, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Afrofuturism is, it's almost a segment of science fiction fantasy. It's a sort of subgenre that's using those kind of futuristic elements, but really tying them closely with African tradition.
What made you choose that area?
So when I started in my master's, I thought that I was going to do a totally different project.
Oh, that always happens.
It really does always happen. So if it's happening to you, don't be scared. But I thought I was going to do a whole project on monstrous mothers.
Okay.
I found that kind of aspect interesting in literature. And that I was inspired by Toni Morrison's Beloved.
Oh, right.
Which is, you know, the classic tale of this kind of monstrous motherhood and infanticide. But then as I came to the PhD, I realized that the thing that interested me most about this aspect was the idea that these characters were being made to feel less than human as a result of, you know, colonial systems in Beloved slavery.
Right.
And it's what was kind of helping them to come out of this identity of human and to become almost superhuman. So in the text I was looking at, it was monsters, But then I realized there's so much more. There's, you know, Afronauts, which is kind of this word for this kind of African astronaut figure Afrofuturism. Or there's people who are, you know, possessed by these ghosts and become the supernatural figure. So I found that idea very compelling for my PhD project. And that's sort of how I got into this whole Afrofuturism aspect.
It's interesting you talk about ghosts.
Yes.
Because and the supernatural sort of thing, because mm-hmm. that always reminds me of voodooism and yes. things like that. And a lot of that is based around, you know, Africans that have been brought over to the Americas and the Caribbean and some of those cultures that have come over. It always makes me think of that. But this is a little bit different, isn't it, what you're talking about?
Well, to be honest with you, I think you're right on the money with that, because some of those traditions end up appearing in these sorts of futuristic novels. The one I'm doing right now is called Freshwater by Kweke Emezi. And in that text, they take Igbo traditions, which are from Africa.
Right, yes, yes.
And these ghosts called Ogbonjes, and sort of experiment with that in this kind of futuristic novel of this girl who's in university in Texas, and she's starting to experience these sort of possessions with these ghosts.
Right.
So they very much do tie to these real traditions,
right.
but they're sort of expressed in these alternative ways to kind of combat with the Western present, right, where they don't necessarily belong.
But you're looking at contemporary, right?
Yes.
So it's contemporary now,
yes.
sort of modern stuff as opposed to earlier books. In what you've been looking at right now, have you already seen, I mean, I don't know how far back you're going, but have you seen even a change from how far back you started to now, a change in some of these books?
I think that what I've been seeing more as I continue are these responses, particularly to things that are happening now mm-hmm. in society, because a lot of these texts are responding to current situations. So you could imagine with our currently evolving
yes.
situation that a lot of these texts are also taking on these sorts of issues. One
right.
sort of element of Afrofuturism is that it's always taking on a social issue. It's always sort of critiquing that, which is similar to science fiction in general.
Yes.
So, you know, when they're presenting perhaps a dystopic society, for example, the one that I mentioned on a spaceship, that one's called Unkindness of Ghosts by River Solomon. And that one is taking on this sort of idea that society is still run by the same kind of colonialism that was present in these kind of slavery eras. That's sort of rupturing the present as we speak.
Right.
And so even on a spaceship, even away from Earth, even as Earth has ended, these sorts of systems still hold
still
power.
There.
So
right.
that kind of critique is very much apparent the more and more these texts are being written. So I think it changes with the time.
You brought up the Black Panther.
Yes.
So to me, I've always seen the Black Panther as good bloke, Wakanda, great society. You know, that's the kind of society we would love to mm-hmm. have. So that's actually a good example of what we want a culture.
Yes.
to be. But are your books more on those sort of positive representations or a bit of both, of some of it, as you mentioned, about with slavery and colonialism and things like that?
Yeah, I would say that the protagonists in my novels are always in the kind of resistive position.
Right.
So in each novel, there's a sort of seek for that freedom, whether it's the freedom from the constraints of time or realism. These characters are pushing for something more. And at the end of every text, they do get that,
right.
that freedom. So there is that positive spin at the end of every single one. Like the spaceship one, she ends up escaping with the help of the ghost of her mother.
Okay,
and
right.
she actually returns to Earth, and Earth has completely rejuvenated.
Right.
And so becomes a sort of almost Garden of Eden that she finds and restarts humanity.
Right, in the way that perhaps it should be.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that the text sort of connects the future of the world that she's trying to create with the past, right? She's going back
right.
to Earth, the Earth that existed before all of the spaceship and everything. But that is exactly the soil, the land that's giving her that sort
and,
of freedom.
And she's learned that from this ghost, her mother
yes.
ghost.
Yeah, her mother leaves
this
her.
This is what it should have been.
Yes, her mother leaves her these journals to decode and speaks to her through her heart. And she sort of learns these things along the way, the kind of map that her mother left her to escape.
With this, so you've clearly been reading a couple of really good books.
Yes.
How did you find those?
Okay,
is it just by pure luck? Someone mentioned them and you thought, let's give that one a go?
It was very difficult. So what ended up happening was we have comprehensive exams for our PhD that we had to do in second year.
Right.
So a whole set of exams you have to write to be an expert in your field. And then following that, we have special topic presentations, which are like your oral exams. So you do an oral presentation. Yeah. You make a reading list of 30 books.
Usually, 30 books, that would take me forever.
I mean, the exams are 100 books. Oh. 30 books compared to that, I was like, okay, let's go.
Bring it on.
Exactly. Usually people take those 30 books to be all theory and sort of secondary sources and right. stuff like that. But my supervisor and I worked together to do half of the list as novels. Okay. And that was what helped me find a lot of these books. So I ended up looking for reading lists of different syllabi from different universities.
Okay.
You know, who's teaching courses like this? What books are they teaching? Mm-hmm. And then kind of looking up summaries. And I started with a list of 9 books and now I've kind of closed
narrowed
down
it.
To 4.
That's much more manageable.
Yes.
Otherwise, you will not finish your PhD.
Exactly. So,
as I always say to our students, you've got to narrow it down.
Exactly.
Stop going off onto a tangent. In your overview, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, and I do apologize if you did, you have this notion of called queer remembering,
mm-hmm.
fractured memory and haunted futures in contemporary novels of the Black diaspora.
Yeah.
Why are you looking at the queer remembering, the queer perspective in, because, I mean, you're already doing a lot just with the Black diaspora.
Right.
Why are you bringing in another area?
Yeah, so with this contemporary look that I'm having on the novels, I'm also looking at a lot of contemporary theorists.
Right.
Or texts from foundational theorists that are more contemporary. So there's a lot of theorists right now like Gayatri Gopinath or Christina Sharp who are talking about this idea of the queer diaspora. So this kind of marrying of queer theory and diaspora studies is not something that I'm introducing. It's something that I'm sort of expanding upon.
Okay, right.
And this idea is based in this thought that queerness kind of has two definitions here. One is, you know, the more commonly considered definition, which is, you know, LGBT identities, mm-hmm. genders. But the other one is this idea of sort of alternative. So alternative times, alternative right. sort of representations, alternative humanity, reality, et cetera. That's sort of queered, right?
Right.
So this kind of queered reality. When we combine these with diaspora, what we get is this idea of sort of twisting what we know to be real to communicate these almost incommunicable realities that people live in. So you can imagine, first of all, having one foot in two different countries, in two
right.
different cultures.
Right.
And this idea of cultural memory and how it travels between these different countries. So we've heard a lot of this in terms of different sorts of diasporas. So, for example, with the Jewish diaspora, we've heard of post-memory, which is sort of an idea of the types of transgenerational memory after the Holocaust.
Right. As opposed to pre.
Yes. So this post-memory is this idea that you have your own memories, but also your ancestors' memories and the memories that have traveled down the line. And how do those differ?
Right.
So I did a project on that in my master's, and that's when I really started to think about memory. And I think that the movement of diaspora and the traumas in something like the Black diaspora with, you know, the lasting effects of slavery mm-hmm. end up fracturing these memories, whether that means that no one is archiving information of lives lost in
right.
transatlantic slavery. So you're losing literal history. And then also the idea that colonial powers have decided what is capital H history and what is forgotten. And so I think with those erasures, there's a fracturing mm-hmm. of memory. There's this kind of loss. And these fantastical novels are saying, well, if we can't access the archives, we will make it up. And that is just as important. Our creative work and our storytelling is our capital H history. And we can sort of build our own pasts and create our own futures through that. So that's where the kind of queer fractured memory comes.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding it then. So you're using the word queer in more of two foots.
Yes.
And you're in two encampments type thing.
Yes.
As opposed to, as you said, the LGBTQ
yes.
gender.
But certainly the gender aspect plays into it. A lot of these texts also sort of play with gender and identity. Again, like I said, if someone's being pushed outside of boundaries in terms of, you know, you're not human like us, or you're not a person like us or sentient like us.
Right.
Now suddenly they're sort of outside. And once they're outside, they can begin to play with these sorts of categories. Okay,
right.
if we don't fit, then that means that we can sort of mesh
make
this category. No more boundaries anymore.
It's interesting because in, you know, queer society, there's the two spirits.
Yes.
Which again is two identities.
Mm-hmm.
2 feet in, you know, a foot in a different, two different area type thing. Absolutely. So it actually all really matches quite well, doesn't it?
It really does.
Did you realize you were doing that at the time?
I think that I didn't realize until my second chapter how well the queer theories on gender really match up with what I'm talking about.
Right.
But when I wrote my chapter on Unkindness of Ghosts, the spaceship one.
Yes.
In that one, she sort of plays as a man and a woman throughout the whole thing. And she never feels like one or the other. And she uses the kind of disguise as a man to move across different spaces in the ship.
Right.
And that really got me thinking about sort of Judith Butler and the whole performance of gender and what that means in terms of almost having a double identity. And of course, you know, there is W.E.B. Du Bois talks about double consciousness, which is this idea of the Black subject having one consciousness as you recognize yourself and always constantly having the consciousness of recognizing how others see you.
Right.
And it creates a sort of double identity.
Yes.
So I really thought, wow, those two really marry together so well, this idea of gender also being this sort of doubled identity at times, especially queer gender. And then this idea of the double consciousness with the Black subject. And certainly both groups face a lot of discrimination.
So you found it, from what you're saying, quite easy to marry the two in your thesis. So I wonder then, I mean, your research topic, unless it's longer than this, Afrofuturism and Diaspora Studies, whether you will eventually make that title a little bit longer. And so to be able to include some of those other areas like the two consciousness and the queerness.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think
memory.
That I think of it like a spider web. So in terms of my interests or research interests, certainly I would name, you know, queer theory as one of my research interests. The double consciousness idea really falls into sort of diaspora studies, Black studies.
Okay.
That's very much apparent in my research right now.
Okay.
But the gender aspect, I got so interested in it that now I'm publishing a version of that second chapter.
Fantastic.
In a journal that's called Gender in Science Fiction.
Okay.
So it's kind
that's
of
awesome.
Getting its own life in terms of that subject area.
You're probably going to push it to the next levels, aren't you? You're going to be writing a lot on that stuff. You mentioned before that, you know, queer alternative representation is different from or it's responding to what we see in society and literature now. Mm-hmm. But can you explain a little bit more about collapsing the boundary between past and future? I mean, you said a little bit about it, using the Jewish faith, you know, post-Holocaust and what people are doing. But can you explain that in terms of more of, say, and the Black diaspora?
Absolutely. So,
or African diaspora.
Yes. So there's a theorist, Christina Sharp, who talks about what she calls sort of the disaster, which is slavery and transatlantic slavery. And this idea that if we look at colonial history, we are told that slavery is in the past. Mm-hmm. And for something to be in the past, that means that it's done with and over.
Mm-hmm, supposedly, yeah.
Yes, using the OED definition. However, obviously, these lasting effects are still apparent today. And for many Black subjects, she writes that these sorts of disasters and traumas rupture the present. So this idea was quite compelling to me in terms of collapsing that boundary. If the past is rupturing the present, then we no longer have this sort of chronological timeline if things are just coming in and interrupting. And there's a sort of violence to the word rupture.
Yes.
So it's sort of fragmenting it, right? So what happens when the past is interrupting the present? How does that affect the future? Suddenly everything is sort of mixed in. One of the most sort of best examples that I can think of in terms of a metaphor for this collapsing is the letter. So Judith Mizrahi Barak talks about the letter as the ultimate diasporic item.
Okay.
Because you write a letter and then you send it to the future.
Right.
And
yes.
Then the person reading it is reading it in the present. And is reading something that was written in the past.
In the past. Ah,
so
yes.
It's sort of this ultimate item that's collapsing this boundary and moving between time zones. So I like to think of sort of cultural memory like a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And then cultural memory becomes ghosts or possessions or these fantastic things in these books. So when they don't have a letter, what do they use? So this is sort of where my project is going in terms of this collapsing. And it's very much responding to, again, these sorts of heteronormative, patriarchal, colonial ideas that we decide what is in the past, what is history, what is capital H history, what our future will look like, and who is included in our present.
Right.
So it's like, we're no longer playing by your rules. This is how time works for us.
Do you think, though, I mean, if you were answering this question in 10 years' time, mm-hmm. how technology is changing conversations these days,
yeah.
because the world is getting smaller because of technology, yes. and or travel, that kind of thing. Do you think you would have, I mean, I know it's hypothetical, but do you think you would have a similar thought on that, you know, the collapsing of the boundary between past and future?
It's hard to
say. Because it's getting, I mean, the letter, who writes a letter? Not many people write letters today. I mean, they just send an email, don't they? Or they get on the phone.
That's true.
So, you know, the difference between when a letter was sent, you know, the old snail mail, now it's in an instant. So absolutely. We don't have that same sort of time factor in the same way.
Yeah. It's hard to say that in 10 years we could be sort of pushing back against time in the mainstream. But I think that the addition of technology is not necessarily pushing against the normative chronological time. If anything, it's sort of altering our present with the information that we receive.
True.
But it very much plays a part in hiding the past. I mean, we all know we
yes. get
certain algorithms, right, and certain information, and what pops up first on Google is out of your control. And so I think what it's doing instead is more and more muddying the past
right.
that we have access to. So I think we're seeing the effects of that now with certain things of the past sort of repeating themselves that really shouldn't be repeating themselves,
mm-hmm.
particularly in politics.
And so I'm going to bring it back to literature now
yeah.
because, I mean, literature is changing. Again, not everyone wants to read a book. They're quite happy to see a movie or listen to a podcast or
yeah.
an audio book as opposed to actually reading it themselves and coming up with their own interpretation of what that book means.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's going to have an effect as well in terms of, are we still going to have lots of writers out there to be able to get us to think and bring in history at the same time, even if we're not even aware that they've put history in it? I love those books where there's just a hint of history and you think, oh, you know, there's, haven't I read something somewhere about da-da-da-da, didn't we back in the 1930s or whatever? So do you think that's going to have a change too?
I mean, certainly we're in a bubble. I mean, we're in a university bubble. So,
true.
So many people are reading here. I think it's bound to have an effect, especially with, as you said, the sort of rise of listening to a book rather than reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one's not better than the other in terms of how you want to get your information. But yeah, the business of writing books is looking a little bleak right now. However, the business of storytelling continues to grow.
That's a good point.
I do think it might be a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
On TikTok, there's book talk.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so one of my colleagues is doing a project that involves book talk, and it's essentially this community of TikTokers, you know, Gen
yes.
Z TikTokers, who are close reading their YA fantasy books
okay,
and have all their
right,
theories
right.
and people are commenting. And I don't think they realize it,
but
they are performing the same thing that my students are doing in their fourth year seminar.
Right, right.
So I think that there's still hope for the written word.
And I hope so. I think the problem is these days people want things immediately, like they've got a short attention span.
Yes.
And so sitting down and reading a book, a 400-page book, is like, oh, you've got to be kidding, aren't you? And what, it might take 4 to 6 hours, but for them, that's an eternity.
Yeah.
Which is, so the storytelling, I guess people are going to have to start learning to make them a bit more concise or
yeah.
in little chunks.
Yeah, I actually loved what you said about slipping the history in there secretly, because I think that a lot of these science fiction fantasy books are already sort of gaining attention because fantasy is so popular
mm-hmm.
right now. So they're almost maybe tricking that side of the audience to read them. I mean, River Solomon has another text besides Unkindness of Ghosts called The Deep. And in that one, it's the story of this whole world of essentially mermaids and merpeople that have their own sort of society. And it's based on the history of the transatlantic slave trade, where they would push people off into the sea, and that's how so many people died.
Okay.
And this book is sort of reimagining those people
that.
As starting their own community of mer people. But again, it's slipping that
it's
history
slipping
in there.
It makes people think, oh, what happened to those people? Yes.
Yeah.
I see. I love history. So there we go. Going to go on to slightly different.
Okay.
You are editor-in-chief of The Lamp.
Yes.
What is The Lamp?
So The Lamp is a graduate fiction journal. So we publish every year and we gain submissions from all around the world, actually.
Fantastic.
Yeah, from graduate programs. So we seek any sort of literature involving short fiction, poems, free verse, really anything from graduate students all around the world. So we often publish Queen's graduate students. We've published, you know, Oxford, from Australia, from India. And we're working on it right now with a group of 11 graduate editors.
Brilliant.
Yes. And we usually have people from different departments with their editors. I mean, it is majority English students, but there's also history students, sometimes geography students. And we work on editing, and we're going to publish this year in July.
Fantastic.
So yeah, we always publish online. So if anyone wants to read it, it's just The Lamp.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
What a great way, another way of learning something new. I mean, the editing process and being like a publisher, which is probably very important in your field of study.
The more skills I can collect, the better.
While you're along, that's what it's about. So what will be next for you? I mean, how much time have you got left in your PhD? And then what are you hoping to do after that? Other than, I know you said you would like to come back and continue your research and teach these young ones.
Yeah, so I had a meeting recently with my supervisor with a timeline. So I'm right now writing my last chapter.
Fantastic.
And then I'll be sort of wrapping up, hopefully at the end of summer, and fingers crossed, defending in October.
That's awesome.
So that is the hope right now.
That's really good. Well, I wish you all the best with that.
You've
got an incredible topic. When I first read it, I wasn't quite sure where it was going to go, but I'm loving it.
Okay,
I'm going to have to go and look at some of these books myself, and because I like a bit of fantasy, and then, as I said, I do like a bit of history in there as well.
That is so perfect.
Yes, it is. So thank you very much, Nicta, for coming on the show and telling us all about your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are very welcome. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and a CFRC podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with I Big Hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.